time zone appropriate greetings on this Fosdem morning. My name is John Boy, and I'm here to talk about free software development as observant participation. Now, by training and also in my day job, I'm a sociologist. I'm an academic sociologist. I work at a university where I teach and do research. And I happen to teach in an anthropology department, meaning I think about research mainly in terms of qualitative research, meaning hanging out with people, talking to people to learn about them and their culture in that way. But I'm also a programmer, and I built a software package that I'm here to talk about. And so my talk is going to be in two steps. First, I'll talk about that package and give some background into it, on its development and demo it. And then I'm going to reflect a little bit on the experience of building that package and how it's allowed me to gain some insights in the culture around software development, particularly free software development. Now, TextNets is a Python package. I started writing it in the way that a lot of academics write code, kind of just in a functional way, not functional as in programming, but in a way that just worked for my uses in late 2017 as a clone of an existing package for R, developed by the American sociologist Chris Bale, and very much on the basis of ideas that he developed. I wrote, a small module. I put it into a public repository. I played around with it for a while, but had other priorities, so it just kind of sat there and didn't really do much for quite a while, as this chart here shows. Then I started putting more work into it, and I started having actual releases. This is the paper where the ideas underlying the package were first developed, also by Chris Bale, who wrote the R package. So as you can see, a bulk of the development activity took part in this time frame here that I've highlighted. This happens to be the year 2020, in which I pushed something like 343 commits in total. Now, I'm not a very diligent Git user. Some of these commits are just, fixing the problem I just introduced and stuff like that. I don't really know much about squashing and rewriting history and stuff. But even so, this is, by my standards, quite a bit of work. And and as a result, TextNext turned from this academic code dump into something that actually became usable by me and by others. And so why is it that I put this work in? Well, the year 2020, you might recall, was not exactly an easy one. I think for academics, it was also quite difficult because we were cut off from our usual research sites. For those of us who do field work, we had to transition to online teaching, which was very, very excruciating. Our students were also, we had to worry about them. They were in some cases cut off from family because they're studying abroad, things like that. So really just a difficult year. Couldn't do the research I usually do. Had a lot of trouble concentrating on the writing I would usually do. I was working on a book that made basically zero progress for that year. But I managed to work on this software package, and like you said, like I just showed, put quite a bit of code for it. And at some point in the year 2020, I was, as one does, sitting and watching a random coding video on YouTube one night, and it happened to be a video by Andreas Kling, who's the founder of the Serenity OS project. And at the start of the video, he made a throwaway comment. This is not exactly a direct quote, but close enough. And he said, "It's nice in a time like this, when everything is strange outside, to do something that's fun inside." And I think that's very much where my drive to work on this package during this time came from. It was just sure to scratch an itch. It's a project that's useful for me, but it was also something fun to do to in a way to cope with the circumstances that we were living through. Among other, aside from just writing code, I also put documentation up on Read the Docs. I set up automatic CI testing. I set it up so that new releases would be automatically uploaded to the Python package index, including binary wheels. Also made it Conda installable by adding it to the Conda Forge channel. And in order to be able to get some academic credit for all this work, I was able to publish a paper in the Journal of Open Source Software, which is really a wonderful project. If you don't know it yet, I encourage you to check it out. Really important work. And yeah, gladly my colleagues were very understanding that I was doing this odd work during this time and accepted this as a regular paper, so I didn't have to worry about my annual review and things like that. But what actually is TextNets? Well, the easiest way to explain it is to show it, which I'm going to do by switching over to a browser now. You can also follow along by looking at this repository, and everything is there that you need to replicate it. So what can you actually do with TextNets? For that, I prepared this notebook, and where I'll demonstrate its features, and you'll find this in the repository. So I'm just going to start out by importing the SQLite module from the standard library, and then TextNets itself. And so the tagline for TextNets is text analysis using networks. And I'll show off how to do some text analysis. You can, as you can see here, we're using under the hood iGraph and SPACY. iGraph for the text analysis, for the network analysis part, SPACY for the natural language processing. And so let's start off with the corpus here. So I've created a database of the talks in this dev room. And so I can create a corpus from those, using a method called from SQL. So select presenter abstract from talks. And should be a total of 19 documents in our corpus. Yes, you can see they're labeled by presenter, and then the document itself is the abstract. So this corpus class has a couple of different methods. One of them is called tokenized. It allows you to break up the abstracts, the different documents into tokens. There's n-grams, which allows you to break them up into n-grams of different sizes, 2 for bigrams, 3 for trigrams, etc. And then we have noun phrases, which breaks the abstracts up into their noun phrases, which I'm going to use here to create my network. So I'm going to say TextNet. And I'm going to feed it this broken up corpus. And that's really all I'm going to do. I'm not going to change any of the other parameters. And that goes quite quickly. And so I can take a look here. There's still 19 documents. They share 55 noun phrases in common. And there's 146 edges between those noun phrases. Now I'm just going to set the random seed to something fixed. That way, on subsequent runs, you should get the same results here. So we can start off by just visualizing this. This is not the best example, I have to say. It doesn't provide the most impressive visuals, but it seemed appropriate. So I'll use the bipartite layout, slightly larger margins, because otherwise it won't fit into this frame here, and label nodes. So our blue nodes here are the different documents, which represent the speakers in this dev room. And then over here we have the different terms. And as you can see, people that use the same terms appear closer together here on the left-hand side. And we seem to cluster into about three groups, as can be seen here. We can verify that hunch by making a projection of this network. So I'll make a network called speakers. It'll be a projection of the text net with the node type doc. And then we can take a look how we what we look like. So speakers plot. I'm just going to use the standard layout. Label the nodes though. And color clusters true. So there you can see how we break up into these three different groups. So I don't know, I'm not sure if this corresponds to what we saw above, but yeah, these are the different talk abstracts clustered by how, so if they have the same color, they appear in the same cluster, and they're clustered by how close they are together based on the noun phrases that they share. And we can also do a projection for the documents. For the terms. So I could say terms node type term. And I know that the visual is going to be a little bit messy, so instead I'm just going to output a table of the top nodes per cluster. And we can see it clusters into four different topics. We could call these, and the central word in the first cluster is research, in the second one development, in the third text, and in the third in the fourth data. Sorry, zero indexed. There's a couple of different nice applications for this. So in the original paper by Chris Bale that I referred to, there is a hypothesis that he tests where he looks at the cultural betweenness of different documents and different terms, meaning how much they link disparate elements together. You can also just use it for kind of cultural cartography, we could call it, so kind of looking at how things break apart based on whether they share terms and so on. This can be quite interesting when there's some kind of controversy at stake. So looking at statements by politicians, party manifestos, these kinds of things, public statements of all kinds, where people try to frame them in different ways and then, of course, use different words. In our case of these talks, I guess there's not that much controversy. That's why it's not the greatest example. But I think you can see some of the nice possibilities here. There's a lot that you can do in terms of centrality analysis also. So if we wanted to see what are the terms that are linking these different clusters together, we could look at these terms by ranked by betweenness, which gives a sense of how they hold the network together. And so we see that terms like the community, research, researchers, text, these are the ones that that really kind of hold the network together. All right, that should be give an impression of the main features. The documentation is quite exhaustive. Provides a tutorial for how to do different kinds of analysis and visualization. So I encourage you to check that out if this at all interests you. So as I said, one of the things that made software development appealing to me, other than providing a coping mechanism during a time of global crisis, was that it allowed me to gain insights into the world of free and open source software development and what we could call hacker cultures more generally. And generally speaking, if we want to learn about a culture, I mean, one thing that we can do is we can observe it. And there are a lot of observers of hacker culture. I think very often that can be a bit frustrating because what they pick up on are the things that they find weird, and then they get these kind of stigmatizing portrayals of what goes on in this world. A better alternative is to get involved in the culture and to really see what's going on. There's a kind of continuum here from being merely an outsider to being more inside. and especially the ways of doing research that are more learning by doing, they allow you to see the world through the eyes of the people that are actually in that world. So in terms of experiences, there's a couple that I want to highlight. An experience is the feeling of excitement, of creativity, and of pride when you're doing software development. You feel excited when things start to happen. You get to feel creative when you're coming up with ways of solving different kinds of problems that you encounter along the way, and you get to feel a great deal of pride in what it is that you create at the end of the day. Something that's often missing in academic work, where the feedback cycles can be very, very long. Software development gives you a very different kind of feeling there. And one very concrete way in which that materializes is when you have a project hosted on GitHub and you start seeing indicators like the amount of stars that your project gets or the amount of forks that it gets going up. But of course, it goes beyond just that. And then on the flip side of that is the deep, deep feeling of frustration that comes from trying to work on something, trying to make it work, and all the different moving parts and all the complexity that you need to harness are just not lining up. And Python is famously bad at the whole packaging story, getting the dependencies just right so that they are compatible with one another, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of learning has to go in there. And then there's also the feeling of anxiety, sometimes prompted also, again, by GitHub in this case, by the feeling like, oh, these things that I'm depending on, they're not really dependable. So in this case, this is actually a warning that is appearing on my repository right now. In terms of insights, I just want to highlight three really quick ones. One is that even when working on a mostly solo project, which is what TextNets has been, it is a deeply social process. So I need to learn about, okay, what are the dependencies that I'm drawing on? What dependencies do they have in turn, and they have in turn? I need to read up on, okay, what are breaking changes that are coming my way? What are incompatibilities? And I also, you know, there are competing dependencies, so you have to figure out, okay, do I want to depend on this one or on this one? And you very much have to read social signals of all kinds to be able to make those kinds of calls. The other big social aspect, of course, is when people come with issue reports. There's a bug, it's not working, or wouldn't it be nice if you could do this, because I'm working with Chinese language and right now it's not very well supported. These kinds of things provide a whole dimension to the process of software development that I didn't really anticipate going into it, that it really puts you into a web of all kinds of really far-reaching relationships, some of which you enter into, some of which you create by having people rally around your project, even a relatively small one. Implication of the frustrations and anxiety aspect is that software development is really an ongoing process. It's an ongoing process of maintenance. It's an ongoing process of learning about what's going on with the dependencies that you're working with, how the ecosystem is moving, you know, in Python world, how does packaging work, and so on and so forth. And then another thing that really surprised me, because before I got really active with this project, I had mostly ignored what was going on GitHub. I thought like, oh, well, it's, why is it so centralized and so on? But it's really become such an important intermediary, for better or worse. For one thing, because that's where people look for the stars and the forks and the issue reports and all that stuff that happens around the project. On the other hand, also because things like the GitHub Actions and so on take place there. A lot just has to go through GitHub, and then you have this feeling of, oh, I have a new notification on GitHub that really makes the social part of it also quite real. So this is all just a quick summary, not particularly conceptual, of what I feel I've learned from my position of being an observant participant. And I want to thank you for your attention today, and I look forward to your questions also in the panel.